Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
We're being forced to put the humanity into leadership in a way that it's never been there before. And I hope upon hope that it will be one of the things that sticks around as a result of this, that we do move in a more human way of approaching one another and approaching those people that work for us and ultimately understand that we're connected in some way and that our service to each other will ultimately serve our clients, which will ultimately serve our community, which will ultimately create a better world. And isn't that why we're all here anyway?
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Ross Simmons of Foundation Marketing and with Bruno Signaco, author of the book, The Art of Compassionate Business, then do check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Dave McEwen, who helps individuals, teams, and organizations achieve excellence by doing the ordinary things extraordinarily well. He's the CEO of Outfield Leadership, and he's the author of The Self-Evolved Leader. He has a wealth of experience in connecting individual and team performance to improved business results, with a particular focus on fast-growing, complex organizations. As founder and CEO of Outfield Leadership, Dave now speaks, coaches, and trains on moving from execution to excellence. His goal is to help organizations build a culture of real, authentic, but ultimately results-driven leadership. Dave is also host of the Lead Like You Give a Damn podcast. In our discussion today, Dave explained to me how increased complexity requires true leadership and how true leadership requires vulnerability and curiosity. We also talked about how relationships and humanity are core to true leadership, and that innovation has an underlying process which can be learned and replicated. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Dave McEwen. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Laguna Beach, California, in the USA, of course, Dave McEwen, who's the CEO of Outfield Leadership and the author of the recently released book, The Self-Evolved Leader, Elevate Your Focus and Develop Your People in a World That Refuses to Slow Down. Dave also hosts the Lead Like You Give a Damn podcast. I love that title. So welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Dave. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Hey, Jürgen, thank you so much for having me. It is just a delight to be with you.
Now, you help individuals, teams, and organizations to lead with authenticity, purpose, and effectiveness. I like that trifecta too. Now, I know you started your career as a consultant with Accenture, and you then headed up a boutique consultancy agency and also ran another consultancy as a joint venture where you work with companies that were aspiring to get into the Inc. 5000 and get them to achieve consistent and scalable growth. So how did you kind of
transition out of that into what you do today?
I guess it probably not so much a transition as just an evolution. So I started my career back in the UK working for Accenture, big IT consulting company, which I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with, and just got this buzz really early on for discovering what it meant to be a great leader and then eventually to help other leaders achieve greatness, I guess. And I realized in the early days in Accenture that it wasn't those leaders that were functionally great at their job that were the best leaders. Some of them were, but that there was a whole range of other mindsets, perspectives, skill sets, behaviors that they had. And so that really twigged that in me, that desire to get a better understanding of what that meant to be a great leader and then help other people get there. So moved over to the States shortly after that, probably about 2013, started working for what was actually the family business company called Predictable Success, where we worked with senior executives, senior leadership teams to help them balance the innovation and creativity that you need to grow a business with the systems and processes that you need to scale. And we worked with a lot of really fast growing businesses. And then about 3 years ago, I stepped out on my own, started Outfield Leadership, ultimately to take everything that I'd learned both in Accenture and then working in Predictable Success and with the vision or the goal of helping leaders at every level of the organization really take ownership of their own development and their own growth and become the best leader that they can become. So for me, it's rather than a series of transitions, it's just an evolution in my own journey and my own growth.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. So the book, you talk about self-evolved leadership, and I'll come back to that in a moment. What I really love about it is, you know, and you just alluded to it there, is there's leadership qualities, leadership skills that people have and attributes, but then there's also the behavior of how they're actually being in their day-to-day life, in their day-to-day business world, that is key to that. And you kind of break that down into the behavior and the skills and also how to, the mindset, how to actually think about leadership. So I'd like to explore with you, what do you mean by the self-evolved part in leadership?
Sure. So one of the things that I noticed over the last decade or so of working with leaders is that leadership in and of itself is a calling. It's a calling that's worthy of its own, I guess, its own approach to how you better yourself. And so often I find that leaders and organizations wait for their organization to develop them. So you come in, you start working for an organization and you say, well, I'll get promoted, I'll do a good job, I'll get promoted, and then I'll get developed, and then I'll get promoted, and so on and so forth. But that actually those leaders that are most effective take ownership over their own growth and over their own development. And they push to evolve themselves simply because there's just a nobleness in pursuing great leadership. And so I wanted to write a book that really put a process and a model in the hand of anybody that wanted to become a better leader so that they didn't have to wait around for their organization to grow them and develop them. Now, there are a whole bunch of other characteristics of what it means to be a self-evolved leader that we can certainly go into, but the number one crux of it is somebody who stands up and says, I'm going to pursue excellence in leadership just for the sake of it because there's value and goodness in that.
Yeah, I love that. And certainly having come through a corporate career, there's certainly a lot of that around where people have the mindset that if I do a good job, somebody else will notice me, somebody right. that has influence in the organization that is perhaps already in a leadership position and they'll develop me as a leader. And that definitely is a fallacy.
Yeah.
I had that attitude early on and I learned sort of over a period of perhaps 5 years, I learned, hello, this isn't working.
Yeah, or just this belief that we're going to become better leaders through osmosis. You know, if you just stick around in enough rooms or you go to enough training sessions or you read enough books, then somehow you'll just become a better leader. Whereas the opposite is true. It's all about being very specific on the goals and the outcomes that you want and putting into practice those things that you know that you should be developing.
Hmm. Well, one of the things you talk about in the book is of course, breaking the cycle of mediocrity. So, you know, you alluded there to becoming a better leader and taking control of that whole process and being aware of your goals. I guess for me, and I'm curious to know what you think about this, because you said that leadership is a calling, and there's lots of people that say, well, I don't want to be a leader. I'm happy to kind of just follow, you know, do my job. It's somebody else sets the parameters and gives me the guidelines, and I'm really good at doing that if somebody else does that for me. But I kind of think everybody's actually a leader. And, you know, if they say, well, I don't want to be a leader, they're just a bad leader. And, you know, you could take the view that, for example, whoever's got kids, they're automatically a leader.
Right.
Because whether they like it or not, their kids look up to them and they model their behavior. They do things. I mean, what kid doesn't want to be like their mum or dad when they grow up, you know, in young? So everybody is actually a leader, but most people are probably not real good leaders.
Yeah, I think that you can look at leadership as just helping any group of two or more people achieve common goals. It was a mantra that we adopted back whenever I was working with Predictable Success. And that applies to, you know, a family, of course. You're the head of your family, you're the leader of the family if you've got kids. It can apply to extracurricular activities, or if you're part of a church group or some, you know, other. Maybe you teach your kids soccer league. There are opportunities for leadership in all of that. And if somebody says, I don't want to be a leader in a corporate setting, I actually don't have a problem with that. I say that so long as you're clear on what it is that you do want, and you don't allow there to be a gray area, then you're doing okay. Where it can become really problematic is somebody who claims that they want to take on a leadership position, claims that they want to make the behavioral and mindset shifts necessary to be good or effective at that, but actually are kidding themselves and the other people around them and aren't willing to put in the work to do that. That's where it becomes problematic. And so I know a great deal of people are hugely successful and they say, I don't want to lead a team of people. I just want to do my job and be functionally good at it. To which I say, that's awesome. Like, so long as that's the sandbox that you want to play in and that's your intention, that's fantastic. But what often happens in our organizations are sort of do us a disservice in this regard as well, is they thrust people into leadership positions because they don't want to go through the process of finding a good candidate or a better candidate to fill a role. So, you know, a good salesperson becomes a sales manager. Mm. We all know that those are two distinct roles. I mean, managing or leading a group of people are very different than picking up the phone and selling. And so I encourage the teams and the individuals I work with, just be intentional about the path that you're seeking, and the rest will follow.
Yeah. That's the good old Peter principle, isn't it? You get right. Promoted because you've done a good job in one area. So you get promoted, you do a good job in that area, you get promoted again, and you keep getting promoted until you reach a level of incompetence. And then people say, well, you know, this guy's a really bad leader.
And that's, I mean, that as a concept has been around for decades, and yet it's still so prevalent in our organizations. You know, it befuddles me that we all are so aware of that dynamic, and yet we allow it to play out, either us as individuals or the organizations that we work for. And part of what I wrote the Self-Evolved Leader for was to sort of try to help avoid that Peter principle, either by giving leaders the tools and the skills and a roadmap to develop a greater degree of competence, or to at least give them a sense of self-awareness to say, hey, I know what I'm good at, and I'm not good at that, so let's not try to go in that direction.
Hmm. Yeah. One of the things I was really keen on in my corporate day was putting together development plans for people looking with a future focus, and, you know, getting their input on what would you like to be doing in, say, 5 years' time or 10 years' time. And if somebody then said, I have aspirations to lead a team, or I have aspirations to do a different job, then we could put together some training programs around skills and mindset and so on that might help that person become a better leader if it was leadership that they were developing. So it was done in advance of them. So in some ways, that to me speaks to that kind of system where you're actually building in that What I'm curious about is what are your thoughts about building in a culture of leadership into an organization?
I think that I was talking to somebody about this the other day. You can grow a business to a reasonable size without necessarily needing to have much of an overarching culture of leadership. In fact, for a lot of small, fast-growing businesses, there's just this get it done mentality. And the leadership model, I guess, or the culture is summed up in essentially saying yes to your customer and then figuring out how to deliver that. And that's typically how you grow most businesses. It gives you flexibility. It gives you an agility, gives you this awesome ability to turn on a dime, which typically your competitors might not be able to do. And you can grow sometimes multi-million dollar businesses just based off of that philosophy. But at some point, complexity comes into your business, and really, actually, that's the point at which you need true leadership. Because when your world starts to become complex and you don't have all of the information at your fingertips, or you can't walk in and know everybody that is on your team, you need to develop a whole range of other skills to lead a group of people through that. And the shift that I see is, I talk a lot in the book about moving away from being a heroic leader, which is essentially stealing victory from the jaws of defeat. It's all about digging your team out of whatever latest problem or crisis they find themselves in, because that's not scalable. And moving more towards a model where you're building a team of heroes rather than you being the center of the universe. And so, again, it's a long-winded answer to say it's all about your intention of what you want to build. If you want to build a business that's focused on heroic leadership, it's all about yes and figuring out how to deliver later. That's fine, but there are limitations to that. Knowing those limitations and understanding those limitations are important. And then if you want to get to a point where you're actually truly growing a scalable business that will outlast you or the other leaders, then you need to build a culture of leadership in the organization that's focused more on helping your team set and attain their shared goals, and in doing so, to develop into the best version of themselves. That, for me, is the overriding leadership mantra that's missing in most organizations.
Yeah, there's lots to love about that. And I think the key point is, in order to scale any business, there's got to be this leadership culture, because if there's just the one leader, or maybe there's a leadership team, but that's the limitation of where you're building leadership, then they become the bottleneck. And it limits your growth, doesn't it?
Very much so. And if something happens to them, you know, then the ability and the drive for the organization, you know, stunts. And no greater example than that than the first time that Steve Jobs got kicked out of Apple, you know. And Apple was a fairly successful organization by all means, but he was the de facto leader and held that notion of leading through heroism with him. And whenever he went, there was no sense of vision or where we're going or how to get there. And it was only after he came back and rejuvenated the company, he then started to realize that he had to build a culture of leadership. And that's why he built a team around him. That's why he built up Tim Cook and Phil Schiller and Johnny Ive and a bunch of the other senior executives who then, once Steve Jobs passed away, however many years ago it was, 10 years ago now, there was an organization that continued to grow underneath him.
Hmm. Yeah, so it's about essentially putting your ego aside and saying, you know, how can this company run without me?
Yeah, that's great leader. You know, you've done your job as a great leader when you're looking at your to-do list and thinking, gosh, there's not an awful lot there that I need to do because my team is doing that for me. And I talk to my clients a lot about that, and they say, well, what would I do if I got to that point? To which I say, like, anything. I mean, yeah, you know, anything. You get to then choose to either continue to grow your career because that's where you're now bringing value in this organization. You get to go and pursue another career. But there's an often held misconception by a lot of managers and leaders that a lot of people feel only is there for first-time managers, but I've seen it all the way up to CEOs and executives, which is, if I build competence and trust and empowerment in my team, what am I good for? Why am I here? And to your point, that's all ego driven. That's a misunderstood assumption of where your value is to your organization. Your value to the organization doesn't come from you being the hero. Your value to the organization comes from you helping your team achieve shared goals and to develop into the best version of themselves so that you ultimately work yourself hopefully out of a job.
Yeah. I think the idea of hero is a fascinating one, because I think the underlying need that many leaders have to be the hero, to be the problem solver, to have everybody come to them and say, well, you know, you're the one that knows the answers here, is probably ego driven, and it's a significance driven thing for that person rather than serving the organization. But the other thing, of course, is there's an element that I saw in the corporate world that, hey, if I develop this other person that's reporting to me now in a leadership capacity, and they could become better than me. And so, you know, there's that element of, you know, they might be a threat.
Which is just an incredible, I mean, to think that people would have that perspective, that mindset is just, it befuddles me. But I get and understand that that's people's egos operate in different ways. And I think you're spot on, pardon me. And I think actually where a big part of this comes from is that a lot of our leadership models are founded in ideas that no longer work. So where do most of our leadership models come from? Well, there are a couple of places. Sports, the military, and superhero movies would be three. And those are all based around the hero. They're all based around somebody saving the day, somebody, you know, stealing victory from the jaws of defeat. And none of that transfers over to the corporate world well at all. And it gives us this distorted notion of heroic leadership in the organization. And then the other place that it comes from is just leadership thinking in general. And I think a lot of the models from a corporate perspective that were around in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s that are still prevalent today are just a little less than helpful. They assume that our leaders should be certain, that they should be at the front. They should be this swashbuckling person that says, I know where we're going. You know, there's one of those phrases that has just stuck around for decades, which is, leaders know the way, they go the way, and they show the way, or some version of that. The reality is that in a world that is so complex that we live in, it's naive for us to believe that our leaders know where we're going. Nobody knows what we're doing. And particularly in 2020 with everything that's going on, there is a need and a requirement for more authentic leadership, which you mentioned right at the beginning. And for me, that all comes down to leading through vulnerability, which is saying, I don't know 100% where we're going. Here's what I do know based off of the information that we have. Here's my best guess. What are your thoughts? Wouldn't it be great if we made a plan to go there? And would you like to come on this journey with me? I think that we're seeing more of this inclusive, collaborative approach to leadership and a movement away from the swashbuckling hero. But our journey is not yet complete. We're sort of stuck between two worlds where we know that the heroic leadership doesn't work for us, but we're not 100% sure what the future looks like. And so it just feels like we're getting shaken up a little bit.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things I think that's required, and you certainly point this out in the book, for that new model of leadership is clarity around the team vision. So how do you sort of go about building a team vision and getting everybody buying into that and understanding and saying, yep, we're clear where we're going? So even if the leader displays that vulnerability and says, look, I don't have all the answers, here's what I know, here's what I'd like to do, giving everybody the identity of that team vision to be able to say, well, here's my opinion, and I think that will get us there.
It's, you know what, it's a simple process, but it's not necessarily easy to do in practice, as most things are, right? One of the reasons, first of all, you alluded to it, is that I believe that a leader at any level of an organization should have with their team a vision for where the team's going. There are overarching vision statements for the organization. You need them. They're awesome. But that is just one vision statement of a number that should be in existence. Anybody that comes into work on a daily basis should understand why it is what they do every day, what it's leading up to. there's a lot of leaders who come in and say, here is my vision for where we want to go. And that alludes back to that notion of the swashbuckling hero out in the front. Getting buy-in, getting your team to co-create the vision with you will dramatically increase the likelihood that they will give their ownership, their self-ownership, their self-accountability to what it is you're trying to achieve, because they're part of it. And so the process involves, number one, you as the leader talking less and not at all, if possible, for at least the first three quarters of the process. Asking your team questions like, why is it that you do what you do every day here? Where would you like to see our team in 3 to 5 years? What could we achieve if there were no obstacles in our way or no constraints on us? What would be crazy for us to think about achieving? And just get them to share their thoughts and perspectives. And I'm all for putting flip charts up on a wall and having people share that. And then depending on the size of your team, getting a couple of groups to go off and take some of those themes and come back with a vision statement that they think works, that captures all of those themes. You as the leader then get to look at that and say, hey, this looks great and this looks good, and maybe try to massage it and wordsmith it a little bit. But that ultimately you come back to them and say, okay, here's, I've taken everything that I've heard from you. I've taken those two working statements. I've taken all of the themes. Here's what I think we should concentrate on as our vision statement, getting them to stack hands and then go implement it, put a plan in place to get to achieve it. You go through that process and it usually takes about a day to a day and a half with your team. You'll come up with something that's much more robust, that's much more living and breathing, that really is a call to arms and that will help act as a North Star for decision-making for your team. And I'm all for having living, breathing vision statements as a part, integral part of how you lead your team, rather than just some old crusty document that gets thrown in a cupboard.
Yeah, well, I love that process. And of course, it means that the team has ownership for the vision, right? Because they've helped build it, and
right,
elements of their ideas are reflected in it if it's done well. And
yeah.
I have been on an exercise like that once in the corporate world that I remember, and I came away feeling absolutely inspired and motivated out of that, as did everyone else that was there, I believe. And it was just a fantastic event. But then the vision document kind of was put in everybody's drawers and disappeared, never to be seen again. So how do you sustain the type of vision once that's done?
Well, it's a great point, and the reality is that it's only once you've got that statement that the real hard work begins.
Yeah.
I think we just believe, oh, we've done all that, we've got it, yay, that's great, we've come to consensus, you know, that was a long, hard process. But people are funny animals. Even people that have been part of that process need a constant reminder and reinforcement of what it was that they agreed to. And so real practical things, you should spend, if you're refreshing your vision statement, you should spend anywhere between 6 and 18 months after you've got a renewed vision statement, making it your goal as the leader to reinforce that at every opportunity that you get. So what does that mean? Start every meeting, have somebody read it. Start every meeting, have somebody share an example of somebody on the team that's lived up to the vision. Call people out on, in the moment, whenever you see them doing things that are moving you in that direction, reward people in positive ways when you see them operate in that way, and obviously provide a feedback, corrective feedback, if you see them behaving in ways that are against it. One of your overarching jobs as the leader, and we talked a little bit about this, about what you would therefore do, is just a constant reinforcement, recommunication of that vision for 6, 12, 18 months. It's only once you start to feel physically ill at the thought of saying this thing one more time that your people are starting to get it. And so those are some real practical things that you can to just make sure that it sticks within your team, because there's nothing more disappointing than seeing a team go through that process and then just letting it lie fallow.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things, of course, that's very current right now. We're in the midst of the global COVID pandemic as we record this. And I think, you know, there's some great examples of leadership in the public sphere today around that. There's also some really bad examples of leadership. So, and I think, you know, it's clear to all of us that probably more leadership is required and a clearer spelling out of the vision. I mean, I think everybody has this vision of, you know, we want to get back to some sense of normality where we were before, and we want this virus to be defeated in some ways, you know, whether that's herd immunity or whether that's widespread vaccinations, whatever that might look like. But the whole idea of leadership, how's that changed in the current environment, you know, both in a business sense and also in the wider community sense?
I think in a business sense, it's probably accelerated a number of changes that were already underway, but it's compressed the timeline or the need for it. And interestingly, I think when historians look back on 2020 and they view leadership and the shifts in organizations, it won't just be the pandemic. It certainly within the United States, let's talk about, there's the pandemic and then the mass awakening or realization of the systemic racism that's apparent in this organization, in this country that needs to be dealt with. And those two things together are forcing our leaders to have to evolve at a really rapid pace. So I think that the new leadership behaviors that we're seeing that we need from people, lead with vulnerability that we've talked about, have the certainty in your ability as a leader to say, I don't know, and to adjust your priors and your assumptions. You know, in a world of unknowns, all you can do is say, what we knew to be true yesterday is no longer true today. So how do we get through that? When leaders hold on to maintenance of the status quo or wanting something to be a certain way, I think that that's proving to be less than helpful. So leading through vulnerability. I think the ability to see unhelpful power structures and inequitable power structures in your organizations, to see where minority represented people are being held down in their growth and development just through structural elements is a huge part. And then combined with that, the ability, just quite frankly, to have difficult conversations with people about difficult cultural things that are happening. I think it's very difficult to separate out what's happening in our organizations and keep our professional face on whenever there's a lot of stuff that's happening out there. And so I think that both of those two things combined are pulling out a need from our leaders at a faster pace. We were going in that direction. And I think that can be summed up in one thread, which is we're being forced to put the humanity into leadership in a way that it's never been there before. And I hope upon hope that it will be one of the things that sticks around as a result of this, that we do move in a more human way of approaching one another and approaching those people that work for us, and ultimately understand that we're connected in some way, and that our service to each other will ultimately serve our clients, which will ultimately serve our community, which will ultimately create a better world. And isn't that why we're all here anyway?
Yeah. Well, there's so much to unpack in that.
Sorry.
Service-based leadership is one topic that I'm really interested in. And the other thing, of course, you said was, you know, we need to explore, or we need to come back to the more human aspects of leadership. And I'm all about, you know, making marketing more human again. And I sort of, my message is that it's all about relationships. You know, we deal with other people. It's really based on the relationships we have with them. And the, you know, that plays out in leadership, of course, as well. I guess the first one I wanted to explore, because you've mentioned it a number of times now, and that's the idea of vulnerability in leadership. And you know, you referred to the pandemic, you referred to the systemic racism that, by the way, is not just in the US. So, you know, on behalf of all my fellow citizens in Australia, I will put my hand up and say, we have systemic racism in Australia. And people have kind of spoken out on both of those issues. So there's lots of emails that I got in the early days of the pandemic. Here's how you survive business in this pandemic. Here's how you deal with this pandemic, and so on. And I had to laugh a little bit there, because I thought, well, you know, as my recollection is, the last time this kind of situation was 1917 or 18, I can't remember 18, the exact date, the Spanish flu. And I suspect that anyone still alive who actually lived in that time would have probably been a young child at the time and would have been protected from whatever was going on and may not really have a good recollection of how to deal with it. And so, yet there were these people that saying, here's how we deal with that. So nobody actually knew. With the greater awareness of the systemic racism that was going on and people starting to, you know, speak out and protests sweeping across the US in particular, but we also had them here, which is good because it, I think that highlighted or spotlighted the issue. Then there are a lot of people that said, well, our organization is not racist. Here's what we do and here's how we deal with this thing. And that was all coming from, you know, people that were in positions of privilege. Mm. But I did also see some really great communication from people that, for example, a couple of people actually said, hey, I don't believe I'm racist, but I'm white. I've lived this life of privilege for my entire life. I don't understand what it's like to have to tell my child, here's how you be safe when a police officer approaches you so that you actually survive that encounter and come home. I mean, that's, you know, having to have that conversation or so, and you can't imagine that unless you experience it. So I've seen messages where people say, you know, we don't understand, and it's our responsibility to reach out to the other peoples, to the people who are impacted, the people who do suffer racism, and understand their point of view and listen to them and give them a voice. So that, to me, that's kind of that authentic connection.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that in both of those situations?
I had a big smile on my face because I couldn't agree more. It was almost as soon as the pandemic hit, everybody became an expert in leading in crisis and leading virtually. And you think, to your point, we've never been through a situation like this. I mean, we've been through terrible times and tough crises, of course, but nothing like this. And to come out and say, this is how we get through it, this is nonsense. I mean, it's worse than nonsense. And so I think for me, what I saw, that was leading through certainty, which wasn't, it just didn't work. There were some people that were leading through fear, both in the public sphere and in organizations that just say, nah, it'll go away at some point, we'll be all right. And then I think where people are emerging as best they can is there's this sense of leading through vulnerability, which says, gosh, we haven't been through this before. This looks and feels different. Here's what we do know from past crises. And I'm saying, you know, crisis, leading through crisis is leading through crisis. So there are some things that we can take from the past, but that's all we know. So let's take that. Let's at least try to craft a plan that helps us get through the short term and then rebuild for the medium and the long term, knowing that that plan is going to have to change and shift over time, and we're going to have to be agile, and we're going to have to over-communicate our whys, and we're going to have to over-communicate when we've adjusted our priors and our assumptions. That to me is leading through vulnerability. It's not turning up and being weak or blubbering or even necessarily being overly emotional, or sometimes it can be. It's just literally coming up and saying, here am I as a human being, here's my best guess, let's figure out a way to get through it together. So a huge smile on my face as you were saying that. The second part in terms of vulnerability and humankind on the issues of systemic racism, I think you're hitting it on the head. One of the things that I've realized or learned is that if somebody says something to you and it makes you feel defensive, it probably means that you've got some learning to do in there. You know, if you feel that you need to hold on to a perspective or a viewpoint that you've had for a long time, probably means that you need to reevaluate why you do that. I'm not saying you can't hold viewpoints dearly, you can, but if you feel under attack, if somebody says something to you that questions that, that's not leading through vulnerability. It's also not leading through curiosity, which I think is kind of a bad friend with vulnerability. And I think, again, it all comes down to ego, which is really what drives everything that we do. If our ego tells us that we have to maintain the status quo, there's no growth and development in that. It's also a very weak place to be. There is strength in saying, I'm listening. I'm truly listening to what you're saying, and I don't understand it, but I can understand how my skin color or my gender or my sexual orientation has never caused me a problem or caused me to be denied anything. There's strength in coming to that position and saying, my word, my sisters and brothers who have struggled as a result of that, I must do a better job at learning how to overcome that. I think there's strength in that, and we're seeing that come out. And again, I think that's linked to vulnerability. And people get scared. Change is a scary thing. and we say that all the time. Change at a fundamental level of your belief system is even scarier. And so when somebody says to another person, you're inherently racist, of course that's going to make them feel like, well, no, I'm not. But that's because they fear what might happen if they begin to look underneath the hood and start to pull at the threads to see what might collapse in front of them. And my advice is always, change and transition is a good thing. If you start pulling a thread of questioning about a belief that you've had, you'll ultimately end up in a way better place. You might end up in this with the same belief system, but at least you'll have gone through a process of truly evaluating it from all angles. There's absolute strength in saying, I don't understand, but I want to learn more.
Hmm. Yeah, and you brought up another idea there that I'd like to explore some more, although it's getting on in our time, but I'll explore this one because it's a good one and it'll lead on to the innovation round. And that's the idea of curiosity and, learning, because you talked there a lot about challenging underlying assumptions or beliefs that we might have by exploring an alternative viewpoint that might have been presented to us and being open to learning more about that. Where that might lead doesn't really matter, but being open and learning more about that. So talk to us a little bit more about the idea of curiosity and how that plays into leadership.
So I do quite a bit of work for a company called Box of Crayons, which are based in Canada. And mm-hmm. Their initial focus was all about helping people be more coach-like, helping them ask more questions. And in the last year or so, they've made this shift in their overarching mission to actually really help organizations be more less advice, more curiosity-driven and less more curiosity-led and less advice-driven. And I think there's power in that. When we take a moment, and let's just take an organizational context, when we take a moment to be truly curious about something that's in front of us, whether it's a problem or a challenge or an obstacle, and we involve other people in the journey of discovery, the likelihood of us stumbling upon a better answer is much higher. A lot of the research shows that taking the time to be a little bit more curious increases the quality of our decisions. But yet for most organizations and most leaders, we rely on our past experience, our past knowledge, our past skills, our gut sometimes to make decisions. And that gives us a very narrow frame with which to look at things. And we fall into this fallacy of our own expertise and our own experience. And I've just seen more and more in the work that I do, that organizations, leaders that take time to question their assumptions, which can feel almost a little counterintuitive because we live in a world that moves so quickly and kind of is forcing us to make decisions much more quickly than we would otherwise want to. If you take a moment to be more curious about it, your implementation of that decision is actually going to be much faster because you'll have considered a range of options. You'll have considered how you go about doing it. Whereas for most organizations, we make decisions quickly and then we go out and try and implement it and it just gets bogged down just bleh. And so slow up your decision making so you can get to back to making decisions quickly.
Hmm. Great. Love it. All right. Well, this has been fabulous, Dave. And as I said, we're starting to get to the hour mark. So I think it's a good point to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's a nice segue coming off curiosity. So the innovation round is designed to help our audience who are primarily leaders in their field and get some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions. Hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that'll inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today. So what Excellent. Do you think the number one thing is anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Innovation is a funny one in that I think that we have told ourselves that certain people are more innovative than others, that people just have this ability to wake up and have these great ideas. And some people are. Some people are particularly innovative. We talked about, you know, Steve Jobs earlier, and there's a whole raft. Elon Musk, you would say, is a pretty innovative guy. But the reality is, as I'm sure you've covered many times, this is probably not a new answer, but innovation can be distilled into a process. There are a number of organizations and thought leaders out there that are saying, look, here's a process you can follow to create an innovative product out the back end. And so my suggestion would be go find out more about innovative processes, whether it's design thinking or something else that's out there. There's a lot of really great free resources. And I think that will help you become more innovative. View it as a process, not as a behavior per se.
Mm, yeah, I love that. Being a kind of a process-driven guy myself, and having built actually in the corporate world, one of the things that I kind of reflect back on with pride is having built a product development process that is actually an innovation process.
That's great. Mm. That's awesome.
Love it. So, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
For me, getting customer feedback early and often is just hugely important. So whether it's a workshop that I'm planning on running with a client or a new online program, just getting some testers in to say, hey, what do you like about this? What do you not like about it? How might we improve it? I tend to rely on that quite a lot. I find that I get good feedback to then go off in another direction, which is, if funny enough, kind of the antithesis of how I want to create things. I want to lock myself away in a room for a month and come up with the best new program out there. But I've learned over time. but I've learned over time that's not great, because you spend that month and then you don't get any feedback on it until the first time that you release it out to the wild. So feedback early and often from customers, I think, is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And that was actually core to our innovation process. And, you mentioned locking yourself away and developing what you think is the perfect program. And then when you trot it out to people, you've spent maybe a month or 2 months on that, and people come back and say that's no good. It's way off. It's completely misses the mark. So you've got to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, what's the favorite resource of yours that you use most often?
For me, in terms of managing my workload and what I need to get done on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, I use an app called Asana, which is a productivity tool. They've got a free individual version, and I'm not affiliated with them in any way. It just fits with how I think about getting stuff done. And so I've used it for the last couple of years. I've tried almost every productivity app under the sun, and this one just was very intuitive with the process that I follow for working through my workload. So that's probably the resource I use most often.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, that's one thing that's always open on my desktop too. So Asana.
Oh, excellent.
We use that as our main project management thing, and also we try to keep project focused communication inside that. So particularly, I mean, we didn't talk about remote teams, but that's certainly something that's front of mind for a lot of people these days because of the increased work from home requirement in the pandemic, and the idea of keeping the communications in one central place attached to the project or the work you're doing is a really strong point of Asana, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And it's one of those things that the folks that are struggling with virtual work are, they don't have a streamlined process for how we capture data, whether it's project-related data, whether it's ongoing communications, you know, whether it's face-to-face versus email versus IM versus storing it in a tool like Asana. And I think that's a great bit of advice, that if anybody's struggling from a remote setting, there's likely something wrong with your communication protocols.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, what's the best thing to keep a project or a client on track?
Brute force? No. I think you mentioned it earlier, which is it's all about relationships and humanity. You know, any time that I've had a particularly sticky moment with a client on a project moving forward, the best, most effective way to move it forward is to lean into the relationship that you have with that person. And that's why building relationships when you don't need them before that happens is hugely important. The ability to just pick up the phone and say, hey, we've got an issue, we've got a challenge, we've got a problem, we've got an obstacle. And whether that sits with you or it sits with them, drawing on that relationship to then come up with a collaborative solution for how you can move that forward, I think is everything.
Yeah, I love that. Great advice. And yeah, the collaboration is really important because hopefully there's a shared vision or a shared goal there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and way back to everything that we were talking about, if you're working with clients, having a shared vision, it will help you stay on track. And I think that's fantastic. I think a lot of projects do get derailed because there's a different interpretation of what that end goal is that we're trying to work towards. And it can be a nuance, it can be a very subtle difference, but yet somehow it creates then a gulf in where we end up.
That's right. Okay, and what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I think finding your voice in how you communicate, whether that's audibly, whether it's written, whether it's drawing pictures, finding something that's uniquely you in how you communicate, I think will hold anybody in good stead. And I don't think that it's ever a finished work. I mean, I'm forever working on how I come across in how I speak and how I write. I don't do pictures because I'm not very artsy. But it's what people will remember about you. If you can communicate in a way that makes them feel something, then they'll remember you longer than if you didn't.
Yeah, great advice. It's comes back to the theme of relationships and humanity, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
All this stuff is interconnected, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Dave. Now, where can people reach out, find out more about you, perhaps even get in touch to say thanks for what you've shared, download your book or buy your book?
Best place to go for the book is selfevolvedleader.com. You can get a free chapter, well, actually the introduction and chapter one. If you want to learn more about what I do with my clients, go to outfieldleadership.com. And I'm most active on LinkedIn or Twitter, Dave McKeown, on both those, and would love to connect with anybody that's out there and happy to have a conversation about all things leadership and innovation and all of that good stuff.
And the podcast, of course, is the Lead Like You Give a Damn.
Lead Like You Give a Damn, yeah. And that's on Spotify and iTunes and all those great places.
Great. And we'll have links to all of those in the show notes so people can click straight through. Now, do you have some parting advice for our listener today?
I think something that's been particularly prevalent over the last number of months is to control what you can control and not worry about the rest. I think in a world that we have been talking about with the upheaval that's going on, the uncertainty, the changes that we're all going under, just take a moment to understand where that circle of control is that you have and operate within that area. Control what you can control and don't worry about the rest. But then also to push against the boundaries of what you can control, because that's where real change happens. Don't just shrink into the center of it, but push out at the boundaries of that circle, because that's where you'll have the most impact.
Yeah, I love that. I love the, you know, focus on what you can control. Don't just focus your energy on complaining about things that you can't change, but push the boundaries a little bit, because some of the areas you might find with some leadership practice, authentic human-focused leadership, you might actually influence some things that you didn't believe you could.
Very much so.
All right. Finally, Dave, who's someone else I need to get on the Innova Buzz podcast and why?
I think you'd have a lot of fun. I mentioned his company, Box of Crayons. It was started by a guy called Michael Bungay Stanier. He wrote a book called The Coaching Habit. Not sure if you're aware of him or if you've even had him on before.
I haven't had him on. I've come across him a couple of times recently and I thought, oh, he's still around. I followed Box of Crayons in the very early days when I was still in my corporate career. And I thought these guys are doing some really neat things. So yeah, I'd certainly love to have him on.
Michael continues to do great work, and he's actually got a new book out called The Advice Trap, and would thoroughly recommend you having him on. I'm sure you'd have a lot of fun with him.
All right. We'll reach out to Michael and maybe get an introduction from you and then have that conversation.
Happy to.
So thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate you spending your time and sharing your insights with us today on the Innova Buzz podcast. I've had a blast, and I hope that the listener takes a lot from the advice you've given us today. So I've really enjoyed this, and let's stay in touch.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for having me on, Jürgen. It was very fun to talk with you today.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Dave and took something away from his episode. You'll probably not be surprised to learn that one of my big takeaways was Dave's point about relationships and humanity and their role in true leadership. I'd love to know what you took away from Dave's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/Dave McEwen. That is DaveMckEown. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Dave McEwen. You'll also find more information about Dave there, including links to the Outfield Leadership website, the Self-Evolved Leader website, his personal website, his social media pages, his Lead Like You Give a Damn podcast, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Dave suggested we have a conversation with Michael Bungay Stanier on a future Innova Buzz podcast episode. I've been a big fan of Michael's since the early days of the Box of Crayons. So Michael, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Dave McEwen. Tune in again to the next episodes of the Innova Buzz podcast, where we've got even more fantastic guests lined up, including Sean Shepherd of GrowthX and Karan Nijavan of Jube. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.